Turn on my recorder. Good morning. This is very good. Okay, so this morning we will examine the chromatin structures and composition, and this is a kind of maybe a little less interesting lesson than yesterday. Yesterday we were dealing with some mixed stories about morphology and things going on in nuclei, and so this is a kind of more systematic analysis of what is in the chromatin and so on. And maybe that many of the things that we are talking about this morning you are actually known by you, no problem. Going through all the structure of chromatin. Okay, first of all, just to start with a correct definition, chromatin is not what usually the textbooks say, show, like DNA and nucleosomes. This is a correct definition. This is what we actually can see when we extract the chromatin from nuclei, and then we treat this chromatin with high salt. High salt, I mean elevated ionic strength, okay, solution. And this will remove all the associated proteins. And the only proteins that remain in those conditions is just nucleosomes and DNA wrapped around. Okay, but when you extract native chromatin, okay, and usually you remember yesterday we were talking on chip application or 3C application and so on. So when we extract chromatin in that application, we just make nuclei exploding, making a very low ionic strength, or with detergents. Okay, they destroy the membrane, and then the nuclei will release all the content in the solution, but without dissociating proteins from chromatin. Okay, so what we get when we do this kind of gentle extraction of chromatin is a situation like this one, in which, as you can see, there is not only nucleosomes and DNA, okay, but there are many other proteins associated that are many different proteins. They are maybe transcription factor, as in this case, maybe chromatin remodelers, and this is probably a new name that you learned this morning. Chromatin remodelers are enzymes that actually take care of the topology of chromatin, okay? And other enzymes like this one that are chaperones, they help chromatin renewing and putting correct folding of histones and all this stuff, and many other proteins, okay? So this is chromatin, and this is just a molecular model reconstruction of what I'm saying. Good? Okay. So first, just to make the things clear. Okay, so coming back to the book, okay, we go back to a book, and in the book usually you find this situation. This situation, as you can see, describes only histones and DNA. Okay? And this is what we get when you make extraction in the condition that I told you before. Okay, so making extraction of nuclei and then treating with a high salt solution. All the protein associated will be removed, and what is left is there. Okay? If you have this kind of image, that is an electronic microscopy image, or this kind of image, and actually these are not physiological situation. Okay? These are only that this is middle ionic strength and this is very high ionic strength. And what happens from here to here is that you remove the linker histone. Do you know this H1 protein? Had never heard about it? You probably did. This is histone 1. This is a histone that doesn't make part of the nucleosome itself, but is used to make the structure of DNA around the nucleosome more compact. Okay? As you can see, when I don't have histone 1 in the complex, the DNA that enters the nucleosome and that exits the nucleosome makes a kind of 90 degree angle, okay, when you put Eastern 1, as you can see, the DNA enters and exits more in parallel. Something like this, okay? So just the Eastern 1 is just making a more compact structure of Eastern, okay? Of DNA around Easterns. Okay, so this is the what we call a 30 nanometers fiber, okay, that is intended that the nucleosome wrap around themselves, making a kind of spiral, okay, nucleosomes, and it takes 6 nucleosomes per turn, something like this, okay. This is the model that actually resisted for many years in the books. So if you look for older books, you always find this model of a kind of supercoil, helical supercoil of nucleosomes, okay, like this one. But actually, more recent studies showed that actually the situation is probably this one, in which, as you can see, is a zigzag arrangement. It's not a helical. This is helical, okay? This is a zigzag arrangement in which the nucleosome make a kind of the same structure. If you look, it's not different. Looking at a section of the fiber, it's more or less the same, but the situation seems different. Question, is more relevant from a functional point of view? Maybe yes, maybe not, I don't know. Okay. Anyway, this is the situation of the chromatin fiber, and the next question is, but we ever find this kind of model in the real life? I mean, the nuclei? The answer is yes. When chromatin is heterochromatic and is completely inactive, you have very much a situation like this one, okay? 30 nanometer fiber. Good. So, you remember, of course, that this is something that you probably have seen already. I hope so. This is the nucleosome with the situation of 2 turns, not really 2 turns, 1.6 turn of DNA around the histones. And this is called a DNA linker. I mean, the region which is free of nucleosome is called a linker. And there's a length that is variable from 20 to 60 base pairs. Okay, and the DNA core in a standard situation, so without any H1 histon bound, okay, is 146 base pair that are in contact with histons. The definition is this one. Bases which are in contact with histons around the core, okay? And this is fixed. Histones are one of the most conserved protein ever. If you look at the amino acid change in the evolutionary scale, it's impressive. We have very much conservation, something like 90% conservation from yeast to man. So it's a kind of, you know, very, very selected situation. So this is a model which is taken from... I have to put my chair there because I continue eating my foot against the electrical devices. So in this way, probably. Okay, so this is the molecular model, okay, that has been solved something like 10 to 12 years ago. And illustrates very much, you remember, this is an octamer. So you have 8 histon molecules inside. And actually, it's more correct to say 2x4 histons because they are coupled the same. And the composition is illustrated in this following slide, in which you have 4 histons that are called H2A, H2B, H3, and H4. And there are 2 of them in the core of the nucleosome, okay? So when you take a nucleosome from cells, you continue treating them with ionic strands, You can isolate also dimers, because there are the more stable arrangement, H2A, H2B dimer, or H3, H4 tetramer. And this actually reflects how the cell make nucleosomes, okay? Usually the tetramer is assembled from new proteins, okay? From new peptides, you assemble the tetramer, and then two dimers, H2A and H2B, will associate with the tetramer to make the histone. And in the upper part of the slide, you see the linear map of those proteins. As you can see, they are formed by, all of them are formed by a section in which you have alpha helices here, 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 and this is very conserved, and is called the histone fold, and makes this kind of structure here. You see? Helices, and this is called the histone fold, and you find the same, exactly the same, in all histones. Okay, this arrangement. And then they have a variable part in the C, in the N terminus and in the C terminus. So each of them is characterized by a different length and a different arrangement of secondary structures. Please note especially the N terminus, because this is a very important part of the histone, and we'll discuss later on. So this is the how the histone is assembled. I told you already, so tetramer and dimer, and two dimers form, and this is the core histone arrangement, okay? And these are the two DNA round up, and this is just the scheme of what you see here, in which you have this arrangement of histones as in color code there. Okay, as you can see, the N-terminal tails, so what you saw before, these N-terminal tails of histones are not part of the nucleosome core. Okay? You can see here very clearly that the N-terminal tails actually are outside the center of the nucleosome. Okay? This is an important structural feature that you have to remember. The tails are not inside, are outside. What it means is that they are quite easily attached by enzymes. Okay, and this is an important concept. They can be quite easily modified by any kind of enzyme. We will describe them later. But if you, for example, use just a protease, okay, so you take nucleosome and then you add a protease to this mixture, okay, what it happens is that it will remove only the tails. So this means that the center of the nucleosomal core, is not attached by, is not reachable by enzymes, while the N-terminal tails are easily reached by enzymes. Okay? So now that we have described the structures of this chromatin, at this point we have to examine, in the previous lesson we have defined heterochromatin and euchromatin as the two active and inactive states of the chromatin, and so we have to examine what is the molecular organization of the two states of chromatin. So what is the molecular organization of heterochromatin versus euchromatin, okay? And there are many things that actually distinguishes them. The first is accessibility. Second is the position of nucleosome on DNA. And then we have many other things like post-translational modification, histone binding protein, modifying enzyme, histone variants, and then something that also refers to non-histone stories like DNA methylation and the presence or not of non-coding RNA transcription factors. But this we will discuss probably later on. Let's concentrate on the first things. First of all, accessibility. This is a concept that you reached already, because when we say that heterochromatin is compact, it's more dense electrons and so on, means that actually is probably not accessible. Okay. And the question is, can we analyze with a simple method the fact that heterochromatin is more condensed and less accessible than euchromatin? Well, the answer is yes, of course. We have a very simple assay, which is called a DNase 1 hypersensitivity assay. This is something that we still use a lot in a genome-wide application, but I want to show you an older application, an application on a single locus that actually makes the things conceptually simpler, and you will understand what a DNase-1 hypersensitivity site means. Okay, so the assay is quite simple. You start with the normal starting way to whenever you analyze chromatin, of course. So you take cells and you treat them with SDS. The SDS is sodium dodecyl sulfate, you know. It's an ionic detergent. And you will extract chromatin. Okay? And this chromatin will be more or less compact, as you can see here in the imaginative picture that I put there. At this point, you expose this preparation of chromatin to an enzyme of which is taken from Escherichia coli. It's a DNase-1, and it's a generic endonuclease. Endonuclease means that hydrolyzes the phosphodiester bonds inside the DNA, not outside, okay? And it's a generic DNA. It has no specificity for sequences, okay? It attaches the DNA whenever it can, in the sense that it reaches the DNA, okay? So if you expose a naked DNA, naked means no protein, only DNA. To DNAs, it will digest everything. Okay. If you expose a chromatin preparation, of course, it will reach only the linker part of the nucleosomes of the chromatin. But since it's a quite big enzyme, as a large enzyme as a size, it will attach the regions that are really free. Okay, the regions in which nucleosomes are really loose structure. Okay, so they leave very long linkers and so on. Whenever the organization of chromatin is tighter and is more condensed, or the linker are shorter, okay, it will not. Okay. And also, this fact also depends on the concentration of DNAs that you use. But anyway, so we deproteinize the chromatin. Okay. And then we digest, so leaving only DNA, okay, after DNAs, okay. As you can see, this is chromatin, this is DNA, so it means that the proteins are taken out, okay. And the DNA, of course, is fragmented because we expose it to DNA, okay. So when you have a cut, it means that this was accessible. When you don't have a cut like this or this, means that this was not accessible in the chromatin structure. At this point, you have to make clear the points, because otherwise you will never recognize these fragments. Okay, so you digest again these fragments, but with a restriction enzyme, as yesterday we saw using the 3C. Assay, we are always to put some points that we can recognize. Okay, so cutting with the restriction enzymes means that I know determinate fragments of the sequence of DNA. Okay, and at this point I make electrophoresis of the fragments that I found. Okay, Now, I want to recognize only one locus, so take it in mind, one locus. So I just make what is called a southern blot. You ever heard about southern blot? Yes? Okay, so the gel, this is agarose gel. Okay, this is shorter fragment, this is longer fragment. I put the gel on alkaline solution, and then I transfer to a filter paper like nitrocellulose or whatever. Okay, this is outer blotting. Okay, and then I use a probe. Okay, a probe that is usually we call it an end probe, means that is at the very end of a fragment that you want to analyze. Okay, so a probe against a very end, close to the restriction enzyme site. Okay, that I used to detect the fragments, okay? And so, if I don't expose the DNA to DNAs, this means increasing concentration of DNAs, okay? If I know DNAs, of course, I don't cut anything, and it will be a big, large fragment detected here, that is the from RE to RE, so from the two restriction enzymes, okay? All the fragments together. And then when I use DNAs at a lower concentration, I probably cut somewhere. If I use DNAs at a higher concentration, I cut other additional fragments, and so I more fragments. If I continue, I get more fragments, and so on. So. Okay? These fragments I obtain indicate the hypersensitive sites, so the sites that are hypersensitive to the DNAs digested. Okay, so this is kind of complicated when you see on this kind of scheme, but I am sure that if I show you a real life example, you will understand better. Okay? So let me take another slide. Sorry. This is... I got a problem. It's not... Oh yeah, okay, good. Okay, let's consider a real-life situation, okay? Keratin-14. Keratin-14 is a protein, as you know, it's keratin. And now the question is, where is keratin expressed usually?
Hair.
Nails?
Yeah.
Hair? Skin? Okay. So, if... Usually it is expressed only in hair, skin, and this kind of things, and is not expressed, of course, in fibroblasts. It's not expressed wherever, hepatocytes or neurons or whatever. Okay? So I take two cells in culture. I have a line that are fibroblasts, okay? I have another line which are keratinocytes. Okay? And analyze the promoter region of this, the region which controls transcription of this keratin 14 gene. Okay, and this is the genomic map of this gene. This is the transcription start site. Okay, and you have to imagine here the gene. Okay, so exonin, transcentrosome. Okay, but we don't take care of the gene body. There, we just take care of the regulatory region here, okay? Which is something like this dimension. So this is plus 1,100, okay, from the transcription start site. So this is 1,000 and something. And this is minus 5,700. So it means that you have around 6,000 bases here. This is the controlling region, okay? And here you see only some restriction sites indicated, okay? So you have this fragment here starts with a BGL2 site and ends with a SPI1 site here, and then you have ECO5 here, EN3 here, BMH1 here, FO2 here, okay? So we have a map, okay? Now we make the procedure. We take the cells, both fibroblasts, both and keratinocyte, extract chromatin, expose chromatin to DNAs, okay, and then purify the DNA, as in the skin, and then treat with one restriction enzymes of those that you see here. Okay? Then we make a Southern blot, and we use an end probe, so a fragment of DNA which recognizes only one end of this fragment. Okay? So, first question, if I don't expose the DNA to DNAs with a probe which recognizes this fragment, how will be large the fragment that I recognize on Southern blot? Can I repeat the question? If I don't digest the chromatin with DNAs, so no digestion, no fragmentation, I only digest with the proper enzymes, for example, BGL2 and SP1, okay? Then I make a Southern blot, okay? And I use a probe in this region. How large will be the band that I recognize? Will be minus to plus, so 6 and 8.8, correct? So I will see all the fragments. Good. If I have any kind of fragmentation, I will see smaller bands. Okay. Let me do the experiment. This is the experiment. Okay? This is the experiment. Okay? This is the probe. This is DNA was digested with BGL2 plus SP1. So it takes all the fragments here. Okay? Unless I have DNA's points, okay? And as you can see, the fibroblast, this is just exposed to different concentration of DNAs. No DNAs, little DNAs, medium DNAs, higher DNAs, a lot of DNAs, okay? And as you can see, there is no change. The band that I see here is 6.8 large, okay? And this in fibroblast, does it make sense? Yeah, fibroblast will not express any keratin. So, as a consequence, the gene is completely heterochromatic. Heterochromatic means completely 30 nanometers fiber organization, okay? No access to DNAs, and the DNAs will not reach, even at high concentration, will not reach this locus, okay? Now look at the situation in keratinocytes. Keratinocytes are cells which express, so use this gene. And of course, since this is the regulatory gene region, it should be accessible to transcription factor, otherwise no transcription, okay? And as you can see, when I increase the DNA's one concentration, I get other bands, smaller bands here, a smaller band here, another smaller band here, another smaller band here. I can measure, because I can, of course you don't see here in the figure, but I have molecular size standards together with my electrophoresis, right? So I can measure approximately, I can estimate the length of these fragments, okay? So I can, since the probe is a very end, I recognize only the fragments starting from here to the site of DNA's digestion, okay? So the smaller fragments here corresponds to this fragment from the very end here to the first hypersensitive site here. Then the second band will be the second one, the third band will be this one, and this guy here will be this hypersensitive side here. Does it make sense? What do you think? Okay, concentrate on HSS1. This hypersensitive side here. Then we will discuss the other one, but just concentrate on this one. Does it make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, why?
Must be reachable by transcription.
Yeah, of course. This is the transcription star site. What you expect to be there in an active gene. What you expect to find at the transcription star site in an active gene. Please, do it. Think about
RNA polymerase.
RNA polymerase, the peak, you remember, the pre-initiation complex with all the factors that need the polymerase need to start and so on. So there's a big mass of protein over there. And this will be, the nucleosome will be outside and this will be accessible. You remember that we made, at the very beginning, we made a SDS treatment. You remember what happens when I make a SDS treatment to the chromatin? Think about it. Do you remember that SDS is a quite aggressive detergent? What will happen to transcription factors? They will dissociate. You will lose them. So in that part of the gene, okay, the chromatin, there were before transcription factors. The nucleosomes were far away because they made room for the transcription factor. But the transcription factors were removed by SDS. Okay? So this is completely hypersensitive to the DNAs. Okay, good. So now concentrate on the other hypersensitive sites here. Why do they make sense and what they represent in your mind?
The promoter, maybe.
More or less. Warm, not hot, your answer. Because this is the promoter usually in eukaryotes, especially in human. This is a mouse, probably. Anyway, it's a very short piece of DNA here. Okay, this is quite far away, something like 2,000 to 3,000, something 2,000. Okay, and so we cannot call it a promoter, right? Strictly speaking. But enough. Anyway, enough. So, let's say a regulatory region, and what? Why there are DNA sensitive sites there? Because there were transcription factors, okay? Because there, in the real life before all the treatments, there were transcription factor bound to there. So again, the nucleosome were a little removed from, okay? This is accessibility, okay? And this hypersensitive site, you have to remember in your mind because this was the very first definition of regulatory regions, okay? So when we analyzed it 20 years ago, 25 years ago, when we analyzed the regulatory region of the genes, we had no other tools to know where the regulatory regions were. Then analyzing them with this kind of DNA assay. Okay. Today, we still use DNA assay in a genome-wide fashion. Okay, so we made exactly the same protocol that you saw before. Okay, this is just another analysis with another enzyme. Don't care. You will analyze it by yourself. We make exactly the same protocol. Okay, as you see here, but when we arrive here, we make libraries. Okay, so we have all the fragments. We make adapter ligation, and then make a library, and then go to NGS. And so we know the sequence of all these fragments, and we can define all the DNA's sensitive sites in there. In this genome-wide, we will do it again. Don't worry. I mean, we will explain better all this kind of genomic analysis. But anyway, this is called DNA-seq. Okay, so it's one way to analyze accessible sites in chromatin, genome-wide. Okay, let's go to another point that is a little more sophisticated than this one. The question is, we have seen that accessibility is different from active to inactive parts of the chromatin. And this means also that we have this situation from when you analyze in different cells, but also in the same cells you have different situation. So is this accessibility, differential accessibility, due to different distribution of nucleosomes? Okay, to answer this question, we have first of all to ask some other sub-questions about nucleosomes. The first is, do nucleosomes display preferred position in the genome? Have you, what do you think? You have an idea about it? When you look at, for example, the first lights where this kind of pearl on a string image, they appear very, very regularly spaced. But this is an artifact. It's an artifact. Okay? So, nucleosomes are not that spaced as the originary picture. But we'll see how. Second one, do nucleosomes display any kind of specificity for nucleotide sequences? What do you think? I don't think anything about it, so don't be worried. I have no idea about it. Anyway, we'll see. Third question that is also very important. Are nucleosomes mobile? That means, is their position fixed forever? Okay? When a cell starts its life, then will be exactly the same wherever, or is dynamic? Probably you have an idea on this point. It is dynamic, okay? So the position of nucleosome is not fixed, but can change. They translate position. And finally, question, is nucleosome position functional to gene or genome regulation? Yes. Okay, we saw already this example with keratinocytes, so it's kind of a simple question to answer. Let's see to answer to all of them questions. Okay, this is just a structural point of view. Okay, this when you have, this is just half a nucleosome. You see, this is only two eastern, okay, only the core fold, okay, and these are amino acids that represents actually basic amino acid that, as you know, histones are particularly rich of lysine, histidines, arginines, I mean the basic amino acids, which prevalently interacts with phosphates. Okay? So the reason of the tight stability of DNA over the histone octamer is due to a lot of interaction of basic amino acid with the phosphates of DNA, right? Okay, lysine, okay, arginines, histidines, and so on and so on. Okay. So, ionic couples. This is a kind of generic interaction because it is on the skeleton of DNA. And of course, skeleton is completely independent of the sequence inside, the sequence of bases, okay? So there is no reason for the nucleosome to have any kind of specificity for the sequence. Actually, this is true, but it's also false. How can a thing be true and false in the same sense? It's true in the sense that, of course, this interaction is generic, okay? So there is no sequence test, but there is a structural problem. When you take a DNA and you make a synthetic DNA piece, okay, and you make only A and T, for example, if you make a small piece of DNA using only A and T, okay, it's not a straight axis, it has a turned axis. This is a structural problem that is linked to the tilt of the bases Okay, the bases are not completely planar, and when you make only A and T, they have a little angle, so they make a kind of little turn on the axis of DNA. If you only have A and T, okay. And so this makes a reason that when you try to reconstruct a nucleosome and use a synthetic DNA or whatever piece of DNA you want, and then you put the histone together, you will see that histone will arrange in a way in which the AT-rich sequences are always inside towards the nucleosome, okay? While the GC-rich sequences are always exposed outside. This is a real only due to the fact the AT-rich region are a little curved, so they have more propensity to stay in contact with the DNA. Okay. Now this is a synthetic story. I mean, there are people that studied this kind of nucleosome for years, trying to understand this, and now coming with the genomic situation. There were studies in which they demonstrated that actually, if you take all the nucleosomes in a genome, that are, of course, there are billions, okay, and you examine the sequences that they cover around, there is actually something like a spacing that is more frequent of 80, then 10 bases, and then 80 again, and then 10 bases, and 10 EAT. And the 10 nucleotides, as you probably remember, How many base pairs are in a turn of DNA? Do you remember? 10. Okay, this makes exactly what we show here. That you have 80, then 10 bases, and then again 80, and then 10 bases, again 10. So, but if you look at a million, millions and millions of nucleosomes, this kind of study just showed you what is the most frequent situation overall. But it doesn't mean that all the nucleosome stays there like this. Okay. So this is the nucleosome preference or what. Okay. And one way to study this kind of story is just to try to reconstruct nucleosomes. So the people actually did this kind of problem a lot of time with synthetic DNA and nucleosomes. And also this illustrated the effect, the second question. The second question, if you remember, was if nucleosomes are fixed in a position or can be translated on the position. So we can make this kind of a study, okay? We take a piece of DNA, and this piece of DNA will contain restriction site or TFBS, that means transcription factor binding site, okay? Now you take eight histones, okay? And you mix together with the DNA. Actually, you require also a chaperone, but anyway, to make the story short, you mix the cocktail and wait for the nucleosome to be reconstructed on this DNA, okay? And at this point, you have a completely random situation. I mean, these lines means that the nucleosome will arrange in this position or in this position or in this other position, random, okay? You can analyze this situation very, very easily because you have a restriction enzyme site here, or a transcription factor binding. Okay. So you can, for example, analyze with restriction enzyme site. So you put the restriction enzyme, and you find some fragment will be protected because the nucleosome is over here, and other fragments will not be protected because the nucleosome is here. Okay, so you can, both situations are present. Okay. You can make another experiment, for example. You can take the transcription factor that has this kind of binding site here, and you add the transcription factor to the mixture, and the transcription factor will bind in this position. So if the transcription factor is bound to this sequence, the octamer cannot assemble on this sequence, will assemble on the other one. So if you, at this point, you treat with the restriction enzyme, no cut, because the nucleosome is forced to be assembled in that position. So you can play, okay? You can understand how the dynamic of the nucleosome is just playing with these kind of things, okay? And actually, what the people did, for example, you can add this kind of ATP-dependent chromatin remodeler. These are enzymes that are present in our nuclei, okay, that actually move the nucleosomes. They translate actively, consuming ATP, they translate the nucleosome from one position to the other one. Okay? So if you, for example, you place this nucleosome there, then you remove the transcription factor, the nucleosome itself will not move. Okay? But if you add this kind of ATP-dependent remodeler, it will move. It will go back to this situation of random position. Okay. This is a play. I mean, it's a kind of that, you know, biochemists do in the test tube in the lab, and they are so amazed by this kind of stories. But you can also interrogate if this situation is in vivo, in real life. And there is an assay that is extremely important in chromatin biology, that is this micrococcal nuclease assay. Micrococcal nuclease is an enzyme which is extracted from micrococcus, as the name says, and is a little different from DNAs. It's also an endonuclease like DNase 1 that we used before, but this is a smaller enzyme. And smaller, and so it will attach all the linkers, even if the linkers are very short, okay? So it will attack the linkers first. And second, it is not a pure endonuclease, but it has also an exonuclease activity. So in all the cases in which you have a nucleosome on the DNA, okay, this micrococcal nuclease will attach the linker here, and then it will trim out the DNA until it reaches the nucleosome. Should I repeat it? Okay, the micrococcal nucleus will attach a bond here, random, okay, cleave, and then it will attach to the end and trim. So exonuclease means trim it as a until it reaches the nucleosome. At that point, the nucleosome is fixed there and cannot move, so the DNA will fall over the reaction. Okay? As a result, when you treat a chromatin preparation with this kind of guy, this micrococcal nuclease, you will only obtain these 147 base pairs that are around the nucleosome. Okay? All the rest, all the linkers are digested out, eliminated, okay? All the parts that are not occupied by nucleosome will be completely digested out, okay? Yeah?
I'm sorry, is this digestion also possible in the other direction? So
in both directions.
One only direction?
No, in both directions,
so,
yeah.
This is the reason why I obtain only one exon fragment.
So let me show you again a single locus analysis, and then we will use this MNase assay in genome wide as usual. So we this is a kind of different preparation from DNAs. Okay, so take care. We don't use SDS in this case. Okay. So we just isolate the nuclei from the cells. Means that we expose the cells to hypotonic solution. They will swell out and explode. And the nuclei are isolated with a centrifugation. It's not difficult to do. And then you put MNase outside the nuclei. Okay. So the MNase is small. It will enter the nuclei through the pores, Okay, so no extraction of chromatin. This is the difference from the other assays. And this MNAs will attach, the small arrows means that they attach the linkers, as you can see in this figure. Okay. At this point, you let for 30 minutes or so, and then at this point you purify the DNA out of these nuclei, and again you treat them with RE, with restriction enzyme, always, because you have to direct your analysis to something. Okay. 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 And now you have. Let's see the image. The scheme will divide in two. Will make you the situation when you have nucleosomes that are fixed in the same position in all the cells. Of course, you have many cells. Okay, so and situation, opposite situation in which you have random nucleosomes. Nucleosomes are positioned where they lie more. No logic, no rational. Okay? So let me see. So if we have nucleosomes positioned in this exactly in the same way in all the cells, okay, all the cells that we examine, so each line makes an allele from one cell, okay, the same gene, the same locus, exactly the same locus, but in cell A, B, C, okay, you have millions of fragments, and if the nucleosome is exactly positioned in the same way, you have only one way to go for MNAs. It should cut in the middle and trim the two remaining DNA and make nucleosomes that have exactly the same DNA piece attached to. Okay? So you will derive the same exact sequence of DNA from this nucleosome, and from this nucleosome. Okay? On the other side, if you have a locus or a situation or a kind of cell type in which, okay, the nucleosomes are random, okay, the MNAs will attach random position. Okay. Good. So you isolate this kind of story. You isolate the DNA, you make gel electrophoresis, and then you blot using a probe here. Okay. So what you find? You find that in the case of positioned nucleosomes, you will detect this fragment, these two fragments, depending on the concentration of MNAs, of course. You can have the two fragments here, or this that is the complete fragment here. Okay? If you have the situation in which nucleosomes are mobile, so they go wherever, okay, you have all the kind of fragments possible, because the DNAs will attach each allele in a different position, and you have a kind of spread on your gel looking at a different position. Okay? So this MNAs assay actually tells you the position of nucleosome on a locus. Okay. You can use it genome-wide. So you can interrogate the position of nucleosomes wherever in the genome. Okay. And in this case, you use the maximum concentration of DNAs. So you make a very high concentration of DNAs. And in this case, you will remove all the DNA which is not attached to a nucleosome. Okay. Not a random cut, as in this case, but complete removal. Then you purify the DNA and go sequencing. In that case, you see all the DNA fragment which are fixedly occupied by DNA in a cell. Okay? This is called MNAs-seq. We will discuss it later in the next lessons. But just stay on this single locus analysis because it's very interesting. And we can, with this analysis, we can also answer the next question that was in the slide, that was if this arrangement of nucleosome has anything to do with function. That is the next question. So we take one situation, which is from East. This is a very old analysis, really old. This is a kind of grandfather experiment. they did in maybe 1985 or something like this. So before cloning, it was really the early time of molecular biology. Anyway, there is a situation in East that is clear cut. This is a gene which is called FOR5 stands for phosphate, and this gene is FOR5 and actually encodes for a phosphatase. And the logic in East is very simple: when there is enough phosphate, okay, in the medium, okay, no way to remove the phosphate from protein to make higher phosphate, so this gene will be shut off, okay, not used. And when you are in shortage of phosphate, because there is no phosphate in the milieu, okay, the yeast will remove phosphate from proteins to try to reach a little more homeostasis. So you can take the yeast in culture and just removing or adding orthophosphate to the culture and then activating or not the gene. Very simple. Okay. The promoter of this gene is short. Okay. I let you calculate how long is this piece. This is the transcription start site. Okay. This is the Tata box where you see T. This Tata box. And here are indicated two transcription factor binding sites. And everything plays here. So, of course, the yeast is simpler than human. And there's no enhancer, whatever, no problem. Everything is played here. And the factors which bind to it is FOR4 and FOR2. FOR2 is expressed constitutively in all cells, and FOR4 is the phosphate sensitive transcription factor. So the situation is that when you have phosphate enough in the cell, in the milieu, the cell doesn't need any phosphate, doesn't activate the gene, and so the gene will be occupied by the promoter will be occupied by nucleosomes, right? Okay. When you have a situation in which the gene has to be activated, so minus phosphate, you need to, the transcription factor will land on this region, okay, activate polymerase recruitment and so on, and so the gene will be transcribed, okay? So let me apply this kind of MNase assay to this promoter. And this is the situation, okay? Don't ask the story in detail, but this is MNase, and this is made in two concentrations of MNase, okay? Only two concentrations, low and high concentration MNase, okay? And again, okay? And the three situations are this one. So I don't put any transcription factor, okay? This is just a vector which encodes additional copies of 4-4, so the transcription factor. So no transcription factor. Then I just activate the endogenous 4-4, okay, plus. And then I, in the third lane, I activate both of them. So activate the endogenous and adding exogenous more phosphate 4, okay? So this is a high situation of high transcription, endogenous physiological transcription, no transcription. Okay. Now look at the nucleosomes. All the bands that you see here, you remember the scheme before, where the fragments that are seen by an end terminus probe. So you see mononucleosome, dinucleosome, trinucleosomes, and so on. Okay, as a pattern. And this is just the visual analysis. This is an optical scanner that scans the gel. Okay, so you have peaks wherever you found the vein. Okay, so this is the scan of the initial one. This is the scan of the second one. This is the scan of the third one. So what you say? This is mononucleosome, this is dinucleosome, trinucleosome, and so on. Okay? And this is a probe that is placed on nucleosome 2. Let's see the scheme. Minus 2. This one. Okay? So they use the probe that actually detects this DNA here. Okay? In the second part, that is plus 1, so this is a probe that detects this part of the DNA. Okay, so what is the conclusion? I let you analyze that. Say that again, this is the control. The gene is inactive, okay? No need of transcription, no transcription. No factors bound to the DNA. Yep.
Maybe when gene is active, the position of nucleosomes are specific. Otherwise, if the gene is inactive, the nucleosomes, we have an example in the first line more dense because MNA is cuts at different sites.
No, it's the other way around. Please look at the, I go back to the scheme, okay? I go back to the scheme. This is positioned. So when all the cells have the nucleosome exactly in the same position, this, okay, position. And this is random. So when in each cell you have a different position, okay?
But the transcription is active in this case, in the position.
But you have to think about. When you have no transcription, okay, no transcription, the nucleosomes will occupy the promoter. Okay. When you have transcription, you have no, or at least you have a displaced nucleosome because there are transcription factors that actively ask for sites there, and then the polymerase over there and so on. Okay. Sorry. So you have, this situation is to have nucleosome positioned. And this is the minus 2, okay? So it's the second one that is exactly over the transcription factor binding site, if you remember in the scheme. And you see clearly, it's always there, okay? Of course, if you activate the gene now, okay, it disappears a little bit. So this means that you have more points attached by MNAs, okay, and the nucleosome is less fixed than before, okay? So this is activation, okay? You look at the nucleosome plus 1, it's not the same situation. Plus 1 is not removed, okay? So you have the scheme as before. As before, you mean that you have these guys here, they are removed because there are transcription factors going on, and then there are the complex going on the Tata box, and whatever. But then you have this guy here that is out of play. This is not important for transcription, so it will stay there anyway. And this guy here is fixed. Independently of transcription, this can probably puzzle you a little bit because you can think that, okay, if there is transcription, the nucleosome will be removed. Never. I mean, it's removed by dynamically, very shortly. I will show you in the third part of the course, you will see that in all the active genes, we have always a plus one nucleosome fixed there. And this is very important to position the polymerase. So when the polymerase starts, of course, the nucleosome a little bit removed for allowing the polymerase to pass through, but then it's placed again as soon as possible. Okay, so this is the story. Okay, we can probably stop for 5 minutes. Okay, so I start again because we have a lot of slides to discuss. This part is don't be worried if I go a little faster, because this part is only descriptive. So you have just to, yeah.
Sorry, I have a question. I didn't understand. MNAs,
yeah.
Does it cut even if there is a transcription factor
No. You cannot reach the DNA. I mean, the endonuclease activity is extremely sensitive to the presence of proteins. Okay, so if you have a transcription factor, the MNAs will not arrive to it.
So, how is it possible that in the say we have the cut, for example, on the site of two plus two histone, don't we have a transcription factor or something else?
Well, this is the proteinized. I mean, we remove the.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. I mean, the assay, we remove it.
Okay.
So we're talking about always the difference between heterochromatin and euchromatin. Okay? And we examine another aspect that is not linked to position or whatever. It's just the post-translational modification to histones. And this is a name, but if I say acetylation, everybody of you knows acetylation of histones. So the kind of post-translational modification. Actually, the situation is a little more sophisticated than pure acetylation or whatever, and we have to consider that. Okay, but this is present in a review that we have as a textbook that I will open today in the Moodle site. So everything I say now is exactly what you find there. No, don't be worried about it. You will find all the situation. Okay, so histones are, especially the tails that I made your attention before, the tails, N-terminal tails, that are outside the core of nucleosomes, are subjected to an enormous number of post-translational modifications that are listed in this slide. Acetylation. Methylations to lysines, methylation to arginines, and then phosphorylation, ubiquitination, cymoylation, IDP ribosylation, deamination, and proline isomerization. That's a lot of post-translational modification. This is the only way, is the only time we talk about ubiquitination, methylation, and all this stuff there, because they are being studied, but not that much. So the question is still a little bit to understudy, and we leave it. You know that they exist. That's it. We will discuss thoroughly all these modifications that has been studied very, very accurately in the last 10 years. So we know almost everything. But Socrates has not to hear me, because we never know everything. So. Anyway, we have a good description of what these modifications are. And this modification happened to the tails. So this is in this structure, as you can see, the DNA has been removed. And you only see the proteins. And these are the tails. And as you can see, these are the sequence of amino acids of the different histones. Okay, this is H3, please note it, because it's the most involved in this kind of modification. And as you can see, there is a code, so wherever you see this pink hexagon, it means that you have acetylation to the lysine. Okay, so when you see K means lysine, you have to learn this code, of course. It's only 20 letters. It's not enormous. Okay, so you have to learn it. Okay. This is case of lysine. It can be acetylated lysine, 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 lysine. And this other code here means what is R? Arginine. Arginine that can be also methylated. Okay. And this is a phosphorylation to serine. Okay, so you have the code here, just read it. I have not to explain any of those. Okay. And as you can see, there are many, many sites in which you can have modifications. Okay. Oh yeah, sorry. And this is ubiquitin, just to remember, you remember what is ubiquitin, right? Okay, ubiquitin, when you have polyubiquitination, if you remember on K63, this means a signal to destroy the proteins, okay? But in here, this is not the meaning. This is just a label that is actually a docking site for proteins which will regulate the nucleosome metabolism. So it's a different story. Anyway, ubiquitin stands in these small stars here that you see, okay? Here and there, somewhere else there. Okay? So small modification. Okay, there is a nomenclature that you have also to learn a little bit about this, because you will find it many, many, many times in the course and also in your life, that are these modifications. So what we do is to first to put the histone. So H3 is histone 3, H4, whatever. Then you have the position from the end term of the amino acid which is modified. So we have K4, because it's the fourth, okay? So in this case it's the ninth. In this case it's 14. In this case it's 27th. I'm signaling them because they are the most important regulation, of course. And you can have different kinds of modifications. When you see AC, means acetylation. Okay, and when you see ME means methylation, and when you have a number after methylation means that you have one methyl group or two methyl group or three methyl groups. Okay, so it's monomethylation, dimethylation, or trimethylation. Okay, so another example here, H3S28 means the serine that you find in 28 position. P means phospho, so phosphorylated. Okay, so it's quite easy nomenclature. No worry. Okay, good. And okay, this is the most common modification, just to make you a little focus on the chemistry. Of course, you remember lysine, that is a epsilon amino. Do you? Is carbon alpha? Biochemistry. Carbon alpha. This is N group, CO group of the peptide. This is a epsilon carbon of the lysine, and this is the amino group of the lysine, and here is acetyl. Do you recognize acetyl? CH3COOH is acetic acid. Okay. So, what it does in chemical terms? Lysine is a basic amino acid, so it has a positive charge. And when you put acetyl, what happens? Hello. No acetylation, you have a NH2 plus, right? NH3 plus, sorry, because it's a positive charge, right? Amino group is charged.
But it becomes neutral,
maybe. Okay, it becomes neutral because, of course, this acetic acid plus an amino group makes a carbamidyl linkage, no charge, okay? So with acetyl, no acetyl, you actually change completely the charge of the tail of the histone, okay? And since the DNA is negatively charged, as you know, phosphate is means minus, 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 when you have a hypoacetylated histone, this tail will interact with the DNA, okay, giving a lot of ionic bridges, okay. When you have acetylation, whoosh, no more interaction, and this again makes the difference, okay, because just 5 minutes before we were talking about stability of nucleosomes and translation of nucleosomes. A nucleosome that is completely hypoacetylated has this kind of arms that are represented by the tails that have a lot of ionic bonds with the DNA. It won't move anymore, won't translate anymore, it's fixed there, no way. But when you hyperacetylate these tails, of course you reduce the interaction and the nucleosome will easily translate different position. Okay, so acetylation is just a question of, you know, binding, not binding. So, okay. Then, look at the methylation. Methylation is completely different from a chemical point of view, because this is always lysine. This is always the N attached to the epsilon carbon. And you see here that when you attach a methyl group, or either do 2 methyl groups or 3 methyl groups, the charge doesn't change. You have no change in the charge. It's always positively charged. So in this case, the methylation is not a change of interaction with DNA. It has a completely different meaning. We will see in a minute. This is phosphoserine, just to remember to you. This is phosphate bound to the serine. This is serine. And this is arginine, you remember? Okay, this is arginine, and arginine can be methylated, 1 methylation or 2 methylation. That dimethylation can be either asymmetric, as in this case, because one of the amino group is completely methylated and the other is not, or symmetric. You have monomethylation here, monomethylation here. So you have very different flavors of methylation in different situations. Okay, just to remember you the chemical basis of this story. And so what we know today is that there is a kind of histone code. All these modifications actually are associated to different metabolism of the nucleosomes. Okay, so for example, when you examine a histone that is being deposited. Deposited means that we have division of the cells, okay, you have mitosis, okay, focus, mitosis, the DNA will replicate, okay, and of course you have to deposit new nucleosomes, okay, on the new DNA, and this is a kind of very tricky thing because you need a lot of chaperones, all the story, but if you look at histone, this is histone 4, okay, this is the end tail of the histone 4. And during histone deposition, there is need to have this guy, that means acetylated position, K5 and K12 should be acetylated. Otherwise, the histone will not fold in the correct way and bind to the DNA in the correct way. Okay, so this is the code for histone deposition. When you look, for example, in genes that are silenced, means heterochromatic, as we defined it yesterday, okay, you find H4 no acetylation at all. Okay, when you try to express genes, and then you see acetylation in position 8 and position 16. So these are codes, let's say, for the status of nucleosomes in that particular moment. And looking, for example, to histone 3, which has a lot of possible transcriptional modification, like arginine methylation here in position 3. The K4, that is lysine, that can be either methylated or acetylated. K9, that can be either acetylated or methylated. Serine phosphate, K14 acetylated, 18, 23, 27 can be methylated or acetylated, and so on. And again, as you can see, there are a lot of different situations that are interpreted in a different way. This is a quite old slide, so don't take as it gold. The situation may be changed a little bit in the years, but we will discuss it later, so don't be worried. The take-home message is that those post-translational modifications that you see here have, reflect a specific metabolic status of the nucleus. Okay? Good. This view that you have seen now, until now, was viewed from a single gene study. Okay? It's an older book. But actually, what we know today, making a kind of genome-wide study, is that the PTMs are first context-specific, and they are quite dynamic. And they are not, as we thought before, several years ago, we thought that they were, grossly distributed on the genome. Let's say, for example, K9 methylation, you always find in heterochromatin, while you find K4 methylation always in active chromatin, but this is a kind of gross distribution. Actually, it's not like this. It's much more specific in parts of the genome. And so what we did is that we studied all the story with genomic techniques, and now we know something that is more deep. For example, that some PTMs always go together, as you have seen in the scheme before, and other PTMs are mutually exclusive. Okay, for example, when you have a lysine that is acetylated, cannot be methylated, of course, and vice versa. And specific PTMs display effects on other PTMs. I mean, if you have a particular modification in a certain position, we always see another modification in another position, so they are coupled in some sense, okay? And the other question that is quite open still today is that we have two copies in each nucleosome. We have two copies of the same histone, right? We have two copies of H3, we have two copies of H4, and the question is, are they modified in the same way? This question is not answered yet. So maybe making a thesis work for your master, you will discover or will answer to this question. Maybe, I hope. Anyway, so this scheme that is taken from a textbook, okay, illustrates this situation. So you have many, many positions in which you have modification, okay, and these arrows means that when you have, for example, this modification here on histone 4, it is arginine 3 methylated, you always see also acetylation to these two positions. Okay? So it's a kind of effect. Okay? So when you have methylation here, you also see ubiquitination in this position. And when you have ubiquitination here, you also with methylation here and methylation there and so on. So there is a kind of crosstalk between the modifications, okay, that makes patterns of modification very, very significant. But we will see them so often that don't worry about the apparent complex situation of this slide. Okay. Good. The other thing is that I was saying is not a gross distribution. Actually, it's very specific. And I show you only one thing. Let's consider the situation at the gene level, okay? So it's not only heterochromatin and chromatin. But when we look at a specific gene, they make a scheme here. So this is the transcription cell site, this is the promoter, this is the regulatory region, and this is the transcribed region that we will call gene body. And look at the distribution. This is just histograms, okay? So when you see this, means that on the epsilon axis here, you have the frequency, okay, of a certain PTM, okay? And this, in the x axis, is the genomic position. That means exactly what you saw before, okay? This one. Position. Okay? It's like I draw a histogram over here. Okay? So in this position you have the TSS. This line here is the TSS. Okay? Transcription start site. So meaning that you have the promoter here, the regulatory region here, and the gene body here. Okay? Can you find? Okay, now look at the modifications. For example, this is the histone 3, K4, that means lysine number 4. And this is the trimethylation. As you can see, there is no even distribution on all the locus. You find a small signal here that is in the regulatory region. And then you see two well-defined peaks, very narrow, that flank the TSS, flank the transcription start site. Meaning that you have two nucleosomes. You remember the 4-5 situation before with the nucleosome well positioned around the TSS? These are the two nucleosomes, and they are both very highly modified in this position. Okay, for trimethylation, blam, blam. Two well, good peaks. And then nothing else in the body. Okay? Look at this. This modification is the same. No, this is very interesting. This is the same modification, but it's monomethylation, not trimethylation. And you find a very good peak on the enhancer, regulatory region, nothing at all at the promoter, meaning that in all the alleles, actually, there is trimethylation and not monomethylation. Okay? And then you have, again, a distribution here in the gene body. Look at this modification, that is 37Me3, that means the trimethylation of lysine position 36. And this nothing in the promoter, nothing in the enhancer, absolutely nothing, while it is very enriched in the gene body. And so I suppose that this modification has something to do with the passage of the polymerase on the gene, right? And this is... Okay, this is the inactive gene, okay? And the situation when you look at inactive gene locus is different, of course. You have different modifications. If you look at these modifications, they are not present. You see another thing. You see the lysine 9 methylation. As you can see, quite evenly distributed in all the locus. And when you look at the K27 trimethylated, you find a wider distribution, but that peaks around the promoter just to be sure that it's not active. Okay, that this is the functional region. So no way this is silenced. Okay? Good. So just to give you an example, this specific topological distribution. Okay, so this is the situation for PTMs, and so if you still resist for another additional 15 minutes, we see another couple of three differences in between heterochromatin and nichromatin. The first one is interacting protein. Interacting protein, since we have seen that there are modification, differential modification to histones, you that are master students, you imagine that someone has made modification, right? Where do modification come from? Will be enzymes. So enzymes that will introduce modification into histones or remove modification from histones. And actually we have three kinds of proteins that we find associated to chromatin that we call riders, erasers, and readers. The two first categories are enzymes. Okay? Enzymes that introduce modification, and we call them writers. The second line is enzymes reversing modification, so they remove modification, so we call them PTM erasers. And the third one is a category non-enzymatic proteins. Proteins just read the modification. So they see the modification on the nucleosomes and interpret in some way this modification. Okay? And we call them PTM readers. Okay, let me see. This is our histone modifying enzymes. So for all categories of modification you find the correct enzyme. So we call HET histone acetyl transferases, so enzymes that will introduce acetylation. Okay, we call ADH, that histone deacetylases, so the enzymes that remove acetylation from histones. And then, again, I cannot read everything, you can read by yourself. HMT is histone methyltransferase, so put methyl groups in specific positions, and demethylases will be the enzymes that remove methyl groups, and so on, blah, 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 blah. Okay? And then you find also another category that we mentioned before that are not concerned with histone modification, but just with nucleus opposition, the ATP demeter remodeling enzyme, actually, another category of enzyme. Modifications are very dynamic and very reversible ever, so there is no fixed modification. Okay, so the enzymes that modify histones, there are many. Okay, so if you look at the different organisms and also in the same organism, you find a lot of enzymes, and notably, so the message that you can remember is that they are specific to histone type and position. Very important. Okay, so for example, this HET1 enzyme will acetylate only these two positions in H4. Okay? They are specific to position. How can an enzyme be specific position? Because that it will recognize the lysine, but it will also recognize the amino acids that are on the right and on the left side of the lysine. Okay? So it will act only in a particular peptide context. There are others that are less specific. For example, this guy here, CBP-P300, that actually are two different enzymes. They, as you can see, they acetylate very different positions. Okay. And this SC means that they are specific to Saccharomyces cerevisiae. Okay. All these other guys you find in all eukaryotic organisms. What about the deacetylases? The deacetylases are less specific than the acetyltransferases. This is the only one. This is a Saccharomyces cerevisiae enzyme, SIRT2IN2. This is quite specific to H4K17. But all the other deacetylases are quite generic. Okay, in human, we have two classes of EDH that are low specificity enzymes, and also we have a class 3 that is a very particular enzyme that uses NAD. You know what is NAD, right? Uses NAD as a receptor of the acetyl group, instead of water, because removing an acetyl group is very easy, just hydrolyze, okay? But this class of enzyme is different, uses NAD as an acceptor of the acetyl group. And they are very important in development. They are called sirtuins. And why they are sensitive to NAD? Because they sense the energy state of the cell before removing acetyl groups, okay? So if NAD is available, they will do the job. If NAD is not available, they won't. Okay, so it's a kind of sensitive enzyme. Okay, so you, of course, you have to know everything by very fixed by mind when at the exam. I am kidding, of course. But just to show you how many there are, these are methyl transferases. So there are writers that put specific methyl group in specific position. And as you can see, each of them is specific to a position. So methyl transferases are extremely specific to a specific position of gene, and demethylases, so the enzymes which remove methyl groups, are also very specific, as you can see here. So it means that the metabolic action of putting a methyl group on a certain position or removing a certain position is extremely regulated. It's not a random story. It's just the enzyme will be activated only in specific situation, and then will act in a specific situation. Okay? So just to know how many they are. And these are arginine methyl transferase on the top, and these are serine kinases, also very specific positions. These are ubiquitinases, also very specific, and these are probably isomerase and so on. So they are the messages that they are specific enzymes. Good. And what about the readers? The readers are proteins that actually see the modification, and you see, okay, once they have seen the modification, what happens? Well, actually, this is important because they have a different action. For example, when a protein reads a methyl group on the lysine, here we don't have the number, but imagine that this is a K9 of histone 3. If you remember, probably you don't, but position 9 of histone 3 is usually when it's methylated, is typical of a silenced gene, okay, heterochromatic genes. What is this protein which binds to this region here? Actually, is a very important, several important proteins that helps the heterochromatic situation to be stable. Okay, so they associate other enzymes that modify the chromatin in other positions, just to be sure that that region become completely heterochromatic. Okay. So this modification here, lysine methylated, all the proteins, there are many, many readers of this modification, actually contain a domain which is called chromodomain. Chromodomain. Okay. And while, for example, all the proteins which read the acetylated lysine contains another kind of domain which is called bromodomain. Okay. All the proteins that read the phosphorylated serines are of this family, 1433, which contain a specific domain, conformational domain, and so on. Okay, so the readers are actually proteins which connect specific modification to other enzymes. They connect, they serve as a connectors, let's say, bridging protein to other enzymes that will make different action on the metabolism of that particular histone and position. For example, when you have, you remember this methylation, trimethylation that was very peaking on the promoter, close to the transcription. Okay, for example, proteins that read this modification connect this modification to the transcriptional apparatus. So to the peak proteins, okay? So they help position in the active polymerase in that position, okay? So that's the reason. Good, so we defined all the stories, and this is just, for example, a cause why we find a specific modification to histones, and just because usually when you have an action, so a specific metabolic status of a gene, there are enzymes that will put the modification on the correct position. For example, when you have this is a promoter, this is upstream regulatory element with the transcription factor bound, okay? So every time you have a transcription factor bound to it, it will connect to a complex of proteins that are called coactivators that actually are writers or erasers, and they will introduce modification in the nucleosomes that are in the gene to help, of course, polymerase to go through. Okay. For example, when you have an active gene, you will have a specific writer that puts the K36 methyl modification that we have found before. Okay, so that's a kind of a connection. This is causal connection. Okay, good. And the effect is, the effect of modification is, as I told you, is connected with the action. Okay, so you, for example, this is in this figure you see an unmodified histone core, okay, with all the positive charges that interact with the DNA, and this is a very stable nucleosome. Then you have acetylation. The acetylation will remove the tails, okay, and this will be unstable nucleosome. But in the meanwhile, this acetyl group will also be read by specific readers. So the bromo-containing protein will read it and help the metabolism of the nucleosome. On the other side, you have methylations. When you have methylation in specific position, you have chromodomain proteins that will bind and help the metabolism in that case. Okay? So you can, this is a kind of resume. Let's see what I have to do still. I don't remember the lesson, sorry. Okay, we are... now we have to take it again because there are many other aspects and we don't... We cannot make it today. Okay, let me see, for example, coming back to the last thing, then we will take the other slides in the, during the next lesson. Let me just discuss this story that we have seen yesterday already with the polymerase. You remember the CTD of the polymerase? Somebody of you asked me what is phosphorylation in serine 2, in serine 5, and so on. And I told you that they are not, they have not the same meaning in functional terms. Okay. And why they don't have the same kind of meaning, now we can discuss it, because we know all the story of writers and readers and so on. So the CTD, as you remember, has 52 repeats of the same sequence here, okay? And these are the most important functional modification to serine, S2 and S5. And when you have phosphorylation, okay, in serine 5, you have the situation in which you have initiating polymerase. That means that polymerase is still sitting on the promoter and is making the transition, you remember, to closed promoter, to open promoter, and then making all the stuff to start the transcription. And what it does, I mean, why do we have this kind of modification? Because this modification on the CTD, this is not a modification of histones. Don't confuse the stories. This is a kind of modification to the terminal tail of the polymerase. Okay, but it binds a protein which is called SET1. And what is this SET1? This is a histone writer. Okay, it's a histone writer. And discover what it does. It will methylate H3K4. Do you remember what is H3K4? Can I go back a few slides just to remember you what is that? Sorry, this is forward, it's not back. This guy. Okay? So the polymerase is sitting down there. It has phosphorylated the serine 5. Serine 5 will bind to the SET1 protein, which is a methyl transferase, and which makes this kind of two peaks, because the polymerase is in the middle. It has a nucleosome on the left, a nucleosome on the right. Okay, and what is the other modification? The other modification is serine 2, okay? And we always find serine 2 phosphorylated in elongating polymerase. So when the polymerase are started finally and enters the gene body and starts transcription, okay? And what is this meaning of this serine phosphorylated? And that it binds another protein which is called SET2. What is SET2? SET2, it methylates H3K36. Okay, so they are two enzymes. One is dedicated to methylate H3K4, that is the modification we find in the promoters. The other one is SET2, which methylates position 36, which is the modification that we find in the gene body. You remember? Don't believe it. I know that you don't believe it, so I go back and show it again. K36, gene body. Okay? Good. So this is an example of where the enzymes sit in the active genes, of course. Okay, we can probably stop with this last story. Yeah, we will start again from this one, so we will remember then.